Okay, the basket looks fuller tonight. Okay, what does this mean? Consciousness is dukkha. In the sense of dukkha being unsatisfactory or dis-ease, and it's in the context of the five constituents of being, the five khandhas: form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. And when consciousness is, say, the basis of cognizing the world around one and then creating a separate individual sense of self that's separated from everything else, then of course, that's a seed for dukkha, for suffering, because it's fraught with taking the information from the senses and then being a part of translating it into a misperception of reality, so that it's a source of dukkha, because it's not understood, it's not seen clearly, so it fosters as a catalyst for dukkha. So, okay, how are you, Ajahn? They're completely by convention. they call me Ajahn, so I'm Ajahn. Ajahn means teacher. I have the duty or the position of teaching. So that's what Ajahn is. Okay. Where in the Pali Canon does the Buddha discuss physical pain and how to deal with it? And then, is physical pain categorized as a sense hindrance or a mental object? There's many places where the Buddha goes to visit monks or lay people who are ill and experiencing physical pain. Then the Buddha gives advice of how to deal with it. And one of the means of dealing with it that comes to mind the Buddha gives the image of, physical pain being like struck by an arrow. It's painful. And he said, but when we react to it out of aversion or fear, not wanting, then it's like being struck by a second arrow. The physical pain is already painful, and then we complicate it with the mental pain around it, and so that we're taking on or volunteering to be shot by another arrow. just being able to recognize that. The Buddha just gives advice around patience, just being patient. There's a discourse where Angulimala, who is a former serial killer who ordains as a monk, and he would go into the village on alms round, and sometimes people would recognize him and throw things at him, both out of fear and aversion. And one day he came back to the monastery with his head bleeding and his robes torn. And the Buddha says, yeah, bear with it, be patient. said, that's only just a little pain compared to the pain that you would have reaped if you'd have had to be reborn again as a result of his violence. But he was actually fully enlightened, so he was able to escape that fate. So getting his head cut open and whatnot, and there wasn't such a bad deal. physical pain Pali is Vedana, and it's classified just as, it's usually translated as feeling, so that the feeling tone of a particular experience, and all experience has a feeling tone to it, whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And within the unpleasant feeling is physical pain, and so that it's given its own category because of the there's a very primal ways that we react to pleasure or pain, and pain in particular. Although neutral feeling, I think I mentioned it this morning, like the pleasurable sensation has the underlying tendency of desire, unpleasant or painful feeling has the underlying tendency of aversion. Neutral feeling has the underlying tendency of delusion. Sometimes we're just confused or unclear, but that physical pain it has its own category and function. The Buddha said, I teach one thing, and of course that is sort of suffering and the end of suffering. If one overcomes the hindrances, eliminating the conditions that lead to dukkha, what is the focus on the Four Noble Truths, Three Characteristics, Four Foundations of Mindfulness, etc.? One of the things in terms of overcoming the hindrances and allowing the mind to become more at ease, that degree of clarity is then, one turns that attention onto the Four Noble Truths. The three characteristics, they say impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self. And the Buddha says in one discourse that there's two possible results of suffering. One result is confusion and more suffering, and the other result is search, in a sense, searching for a way out. And if one's too overwhelmed by suffering or too caught up in suffering, then it promotes that confusion and more suffering. So that there's a need to use the dukkha that we experience to search for the way out, search for a path. And the path that the Buddha gives is one of that quality of clarity, and is very, very necessary. Like, it's interesting to a juxtaposition of the, say, the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha talking, I teach only one thing, suffering, the end of suffering, and or Four Noble Truths, suffering, cause of suffering, cessation of suffering, path leading to cessation of suffering. And you know, one can think, wow, there's always suffering. And it's true, it's really, but then if one reflects on the, say, like the Eightfold Path, all of the factors of the Eightfold Path actually lead to happiness and well-being. The qualities of that are associated with virtue, right speech, right action, right livelihood, leads to happiness and well-being. Right concentration, the factors of right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, and those are something that lead to happiness and well-being. Right view, right intention are all leading to a quality of happiness and well-being. So that the path of practice is one of cultivating those things which lead to well-being. The focus of attention and the thing that we have to really, or that we really have to understand, is suffering. Because that's there's all of the nuances of entanglement and complication that we create in our mind and in our life those can be resolved, but we have to really pay attention to the ways that we do create discontent, dissatisfaction, dis-ease. So that those are all nuances of suffering. How does one develop faith or trust? The Pali word for faith is saddha, and faith is something in the English language that there's a lot of suspicion around, but maybe better translated as trust, as in here, or confidence. And the traditional cause for faith to arise is the awakening of the Buddha, in the sense that when we reflect, investigate, and consider the fact that the Buddha was able to be awakened, to be enlightened, to be liberated, and then felt that there were those beings with little dust in their eyes who would be able to understand. And that's what he spent 45 years teaching, and then that teaching is the, say, the cause for 2,500 years later, this same teaching to be applicable, to be beneficial. So reflecting on the awakening of the Buddha and the kind of the result of that, and that it's possible, and that the Buddha felt it was possible for everybody else. So there's I think that's a basis for our faith and confidence. Do you think it's possible to have fear decrease by coming back to the breath? It can be a helpful anchor if we're having to confront fear. So that by coming back to the breath, then we've got an anchor that holds us, because fear tends to, either confuses us or we want to move away from something, or it just clouds the mind. So that by coming back to the breath, and we're giving ourselves a point of stability to be able to reflect and investigate, and to understand how's this fear work? What is the what is it that seems so worthy of fear? And also by coming back to the breath, we can relax the body, because you oftentimes, and that's I mean, again, it's interesting to pay attention to how the mind and the body keep a mood sort of revolving or moving or gives it life, so that we experience something that we're fearful of, and then the body tenses up, the body knots up, the body sort of comes in on itself, and then fear keeps moving. So that by being able to, by using the breath as a tool to help relax, settle, find a point of stability, then that gives an opportunity for that fear to dissipate. And then the body relaxes. So sort of like if your body is really relaxed, it's really hard to work up anxiety and fear. And it's just this the way it works. It has to have something that keeps it going. It's like one of the most common drugs that are given for anxiety, is Valium. And Valium's it's a muscle relaxant. It doesn't affect the mind in the sense that other than when the body is relaxed, then that kind of anxiety, it doesn't spin on itself, doesn't spin out, by coming back to the breath, then there's an ability to give the opportunity for that kind of fear to dissipate. Also, with fear, just being willing to be present with fear diminishes it. It's sort of one of the things that keeps fear going is the kind of the anxiety we have around fear. So it sort of keeps it spinning, keeps it moving. This summer I was at the Spirit Rock family retreat, and I told the teens a story they actually asked me, have you ever been afraid of anything, or been fearful as a monk? Have you had experienced fear? And I said, oh yeah, sure, and told them a story of being on my own, living by myself in a very simple hut along the very large forest area along the border of Burma. And the nearest village was about a kilometer and a half away. It was just really jungle. And one night, doing walking meditation at night, and then having this sensation of it was almost before the sensation of fear coming over me, almost before what I started to even cognize it, in the sense that I could smell a tiger. Tiger has a very, very pungent odor, and I could hear it circling. And that was fear. And I didn't think in my mind, oh, I'm afraid. It was like, just reach up and grab you by the throat. So that this tremendous fear, and it was very interesting, because it just sort of all the hair stood up on my body, and it was almost precognition. It was just bang, as soon as that was there, everything, the whole body was flooded with fear. And and I'm by myself out in the jungle, and so I said, okay, now what do I do? And what came to mind, which was it could tie back to the question about faith, because what I remembered was a sutta where the Buddha talked about his own practice and going out into solitary places, going out to charnel grounds, going out to forests, where he would experience fear and a fear and dread. And what the Buddha would do would, whatever posture he experienced that fear in, then he would stay in that posture and just be with it. So I remembered that sutta. So then I just stayed on the walking path and just kept walking back and forth. And of course, the mind is, sometimes it's mindful, sometimes it's completely spinning out. You know, and then sort of thinking, oh, what would I do if it really attacked? And I started going through the options, and I said, well, you just die. it's very simple. I kept walking, and then the fear really went away. And then I went into my hut, and I sat. And the hut is very flimsy, so I was sitting meditation, and then all of a sudden, just these waves of sort of fear coming. What are you doing out in this forest by yourself, waiting for a tiger to eat you? But then, just sitting with that, that's why. And it was way, way late at night before I really sort of, kept working with the fear as it coming up and just staying with it and alternating until it really felt, the fear's gone. One of the things that is really helpful with fear is really being willing to be present for it, and it'll tend to dissipate. Also, in terms of fear, as you investigate it and start looking at it, it's almost. You start seeing it's almost a causal condition for so many other defilements to arise. So much of our desire is just about covering up anxiety and fear. Give me something to keep me busy, and aversion or ill will is oftentimes triggered because we're anxious or fearful, or we're not comfortable. So many of the root defilements sort of come back to that quality of fear. Okay, could you elaborate a bit more on what the malleable mind is and how it differs from pliable? I was thinking after I, actually even during the talk I was giving, I have to take the word and bring it back to the Pali, The word that is, because I think I probably mixed it up, because the words themselves, malleable and pliable, they're pretty similar. What I was thinking about it is probably the word pliable is the word that is in the Pali about soft or gentle. That quality of softness and gentleness that isn't stubborn, it isn't hard edged in its positions it takes, so that it's pliable. It can work. Be willing to work with conditions around it. And malleable, I think one of the meanings of malleable is something that is maybe easily worked, and the Buddha referring that again to gold, so it's easily worked. And one of the word that the Buddha uses is kamaniya. So the word kamma is used. And kamma is the verb to do, this action. The word kamaniya is sort of like ready for work. It's ready for action. It's ready to be utilized. It's ready to be put to its task, so that that quality of malleable is ready to work, to be utilized in a skillful way. Can you offer some more instructions on sleepiness when it is very strong? I'll just sort of skip over things, because there's many, many ways of dealing with sleepiness or drowsiness, and as I mentioned, one is posture, another is taking an object of meditation that's very clear, like really clarifying the meditation object, and sometimes it's like giving the mind a bit more work to do, if it's too kind of loose or ill-defined, then sort of drowsiness can easily set in, or because even if you're tired, like physically tired, you can sometimes work through that quite easily by, say, like keeping the eyes open, being very kind of attentive to the breath, using a mantra at the same time. They're all ways of generating energy. So then it helps to overcome that sleepiness. Also, sometimes if one's doing sitting meditation and it's just continually being overwhelmed, just getting up and doing walking meditation. It's much better. It's harder to fall asleep doing walking meditation. But it's also more fruitful to be doing, bringing energy and doing the walking meditation than struggling with the sitting posture with sleepiness and drowsiness. So sometimes it's you try this, try that, and it's not working. So that just to go and do walking meditation or standing meditation, that's another option. It's not so popular. But the first year that I was a monk, I lived in a monastery that the evening meeting was an hour walking, hour standing, and an hour sitting. That was sort of an hour in each posture, and you find that this standing meditation is really really helpful. Although I remember one monk at Wat Nanachat using standing meditation and still finding it difficult to deal with sleepiness. So he stood in front of a door, quite close by, and of course we're all sitting meditation. He's fallen asleep, hitting his head on the door. Of course, that alleviated the sleepiness as well. So, just a lot of experimenting, actually, with sleepiness is good. But just a lot of finding ways to bring up energy. How do we work with self-destructive and harmful repetitive patterns in our life? We can't really force change, and which is true, because oftentimes what happens when we recognize a particular tendency that is harmful and unskillful, it's easy to slip into a, say, like an aversion or vipavatana, the desire to not become, which is pushing away, it's annihilating, trying to annihilate something, and that's a good way to actually give it more power in a different way. So that with things that we really recognize as being harmful, then being able to reflect on the painful result. It's like really, really seeing it clearly. And because so often what our tendencies are, we try to annihilate, or we try to justify it, or we try to or we just want to ignore it and hope it goes away by itself, but really being able to say, wow, that's really painful. And that doesn't mean that it's going to change right then, but it does remind us that is harmful, and I really need to do something about it. And so that one starts to build a momentum of, it's like I mentioned before, of the, say, seeing the dukkha, it can then be the seed or the causal condition for that search for a solution, a search for a way out. And that motivation will then, will we start to gain momentum and encourage ourselves? Because it's you can't just force it through. Force of will usually has a there tends to be so much self involved that it tends to be counterproductive. What is a skillful way of dealing with worry and aversion with respect to the current economic and political situation? Yeah, that's really worthy of worry and aversion. even in a monastery, you can think, God, how can these people be like this? But you know, I think the reflection on just the nature of the human condition it's fraught with suffering because of ignorance and desire, and that's an impersonal, say, like an impersonal forces that push people into untenable positions and counterproductive ways of being. So that trying to pull oneself back from the personalizing of it or the projection of it in terms of those individuals, those things, those people, because they are. It isn't as if it's the economic situation is because of some the invisible hand of the market sort of thing. I mean, this is choices that people have made that have really generated it, and it's by real people. So that being able to step back and try to see it in terms of causes and conditions rather than personalities and these kind of personal forces. Another is just to reflect on cycles of samsara. I mean, that's the world is constantly going through cycles of difficulty and disruption and instability, and it's actually one of the reasons why the Buddha he had a window of opportunity in the society that he was living at the time. It was a particular time of instability within the society. And it was starting to have a cash economy was starting to really establish itself. Trading was really starting to establish itself. A rise of kind of city states, consolidation of power, and of course the attendant competitions and so there was a degree of stability. There was actually our instability that was actually the Buddha's teaching resonated with people and saying, yeah, there is suffering and there's a way out. And it's not through waiting for all the conditions externally to be to one's liking or to one's benefit and well-being, but we can take a situation and we can recognize how we create the suffering around it. And then personally, of course, on benefits, and then a society would certainly benefit the more clarity there is, and more people with clarity within it. Pretty recently, I realized that I don't have to do anything to be present or mindful. 10 years on the path. No big explosion or nothing like that. This shift happened so gradually, I hardly noticed. What now? Please comment. It is very interesting to recognize that it's the path that brings the fruit, as opposed to me doing something special. The more we, there's a certain compelling quality I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and then I'll get like that, and then there's going to be this explosion, and then I'll be really special. Anyways, well, actually, the path is a lot more subtle than that. So then as we start to recognize, that quality of mindfulness, attention, clarity, we can be accessing all the time. Now, then, how to sustain it, and how to direct attention to the things that are really going to benefit, so that that directing of attention to Four Noble Truths, directing of attention to what are the things that what's the What's the benefit? What's the drawback of things? What's the way out? Or directing attention to the causal nature of things. Really, in that, what are the causes? What are the conditions that are working here? So that one starting step back from the personal and the personalizing of things, but seeing how there's causes and conditions that are functioning, rather than that person or that person or me or whatever. So that seeing things in a broader perspective, and that gives an opportunity for relinquishment and peace and real settling. Is it permissible to stand at the back of the room during a sitting session? Absolutely. More conducive to mindfulness and alertness, whatever works, whatever helps. So long as it's not chanting while we're sitting. Works for me to chant really loud, you know. But certainly standing or walking, absolutely. What does it mean to fully understand what causes us to suffer? What it means is that there's a, by really understanding the suffering and its cause, that in itself is the window of clarity, and the trigger that allows the mind to really relinquish and let go and realize and experience the cessation of suffering. Cessation of suffering doesn't sort of come out of a vacuum or out of good intentions or high hopes. It comes through seeing things clearly, and it's that attention to suffering and its causes. There's a lovely quote by Marcel Proust, said, "The mind aspires to truth and beauty, but pain we obey." So it gets our attention, and we have to do something about it. And that's a good thing. Sometimes I label thoughts as planning, memory, and fantasy. How do these labels fit with the five hindrances? Are they forms of restlessness? Yeah, I think that's a good way of that sort of planning mind or it's not settled. It's looking for something. It's worried a little bit about this. It's trying to figure it all out and trying to have an answer for something. And then you say, it's just restlessness. I can clump it together under that and put it down. Some say that a fully liberated person must avoid society because they are so fully selfless that even if asked to give away their eye, they would do it, unconcerned for their own life. How would you respond to such an assumption? One of the characteristics of a fully liberated person is that they're wise. So that wisdom in action. Regarding your instruction on sloth and torpor, can you explain how to look for the light in your mind? P.S. How to work with using buddho without forcing, how to apply the right effort, and how to invite the brightness to grow when it is present. At first it's just a concept, but you have to begin with that. It's an alternative to the mind collapsing in dullness and darkness. So it's like just bringing it up as a concept, bringing it up as an idea, and sort of brightness, and connecting it with the breath. And it's sort of like you're experimenting and taking an alternative object of attention that is, you say, generated by the mind, generated by thought. But it's one that has a good result. And of course it can fade in and out, it'll shift but it's like giving the option to the mind to experience it. Because when we present an option and then reinforce it with our good intention, then it starts to build momentum. So then it's something that begins as a thought or a concept, it's able to start to stabilize as a perception. And then with that perception, you can stabilize that perception and gently, if one grabs on it tightly, then it'll crumble. But it's that kind of experimenting, working with it in a gentle way, but seeing the benefit of, say, like a bright mind as opposed to a dull mind. Okay, there's just two left. I was gonna pack it in, but how do you recommend I work with sexual energy? One of the things with, I mean, one is just seeing it as natural. It's sort of part of the human conditioning. When it's not channeled in a skillful way, it can be extraordinarily disruptive internally. And then, of course, that's the whole point of, for the five precepts, that there's a refraining from sexual misconduct. It's giving a container that builds trust in relationship on a retreat like this, or for a monastic, people living in a monastery, then stepping back from the whole expression of sexuality and following up on it, it gives a real relief and break. But again, if there's, say, sexual fantasy comes up, if you just try to push it down, it really doesn't work. To be able to, again, sort of like really, that's where it's helpful just to really label things clearly, like in terms of the hindrances. Say, oh, okay, that's the hindrance of sense desire, sexuality, sexual energy. That's the hindrance of sense desire. And the the compulsion to identify with it, and then I mean it's very agitating, and it also tends to, of course, it's looking for an object, so that it'll find it wherever, and that it's really helpful to just sort of okay, there's sexual thought, sexual fantasy, sexual energy is there. Okay, what's it connected with? Where do I feel it? Okay, well, I feel it in the body. I mean, it's a mental state as well, but I feel it in the body. Well, what's the nature of the body? And you think, well, that's where those classic meditation on the 32 parts of the body are very helpful for taming and channeling sexual energy, because you start to looking at the body as opposed to it being either one's own vehicle for gratification of sexual energy or the projection externally toward others of sexual energy. Then it's sort of, oh, that's the body. Hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bone marrow, internal organs, all the various fluids that ooze out here and there or slosh around inside. Think, wow, oh, oh, give me a break from this sexual energy stuff. Why, what's all the fuss about? So then it's a helpful antidote. Questions and concerns are incessantly arising about my relationship with my partner. When it comes to important choices in life, how can one discern between a credible intuitive sense and the habitual patterns of restlessness and fear? Yeah, sometimes it's really jumbled, isn't it? One does have to pay attention to the kind of intuitive feelings. But again, that's where it's helpful put another plug in for the five hindrances. Being able to sort of really sort of label and see clearly, oh, that's that hindrance pain popping up again. Well, that's the hindrance of restlessness and anxiety. Oh, that's the hindrance of doubt. That's the hindrance of aversion. That's the hindrance of desire. And so that we become more and more familiar with the way those hindrances work, that gives us a base of clarity to start to see, okay, well, maybe one, it's just more of my own stuff that I'm projecting onto somebody else. Or it gives a clarity to sort of say, maybe I should explore this. But then that's also, it's important. That's where, rather than dealing with it on one's, in one's own mind, sometimes that's where skill in communication is really needed, where actual dialogue and communication and sharing. And of course, that has to come from a place of trust. And that trust really has to come from precepts and a similar perspectives. By communicating skillfully, then there's oftentimes one can provide the basis for understanding and trust to continue to manifest. Let's have a short break and come back about 5 minutes for evening puja.